our friends' sphere sometimes a little narrow, and we don't get to have conversations with other people that are just at a notch maybe above us or two notches above us and where we're wanting to go. It's like we're never satisfied.
Yeah, I agree with you.
We're always seeking.
So today we talked to Russ Morgan from Wealth Without Wall Street, and we chronicled his journey from being an actual financial advisor and helping people manage their money and different things like that to him having a shift in thought to saying, hey, something's not right about this, to him discovering and meeting a guy named Nelson Nash who taught him the concept of infinite banking, which then in turn has helped him to, as we filmed this, have 21 sources of passive income and allowing himself and his team of people to run a wonderfully successful business that's based here in Birmingham, but he has clients and people all over the planet that call him a mentor and call him a friend and call him an expert. You are going to love this episode with Russ Morgan. Russ, thank you so much for joining us today. So I've got Russ here, and probably the last 10 minutes probably could have been on here. We stopped ourselves two or three times talking right about these things. So I've got Russ Morgan here from Wealth Without Wall Street. That's the box that he's sort of known for and lives in. Got his passive income shirt on today, so we'll talk about that in a second. But I'm so glad to have you. Thank you so much. First things first, who are you? What do you do? And why does it really matter?
Yeah. Well, man, thank you for having me in. And in person, by the way, this is the first live podcast I've been on. I had to put on socks and shoes today.
I had to get my car.
I mean, this is great, man, to interact with people.
Right.
Yeah. So we run a company called Wealth Without Wall Street. My background is, I guess this is where I tell you all my former sins, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
I'm a former certified financial planner.
No one else is listening. You're good.
Yeah. Well, I think it's pertinent to talk about all that stuff, man. Like, I was professionally trained to separate people from their money, man. Mm. Like, my job was to get you to give it to me, keep it for as long as I could, right? Make it as hard as possible for you to get it back. I mean, that's the typical way to building a fee-based practice in the Wall Street playbooks, man. And I did that for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And the market crashed, and I realized I wasn't the financial genius that I thought I was at the time, right? And it sent me on a path to just seeking what else was there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a theme in my life is like, what's next? What now, right? Yeah. When a door closes, how do I open up another one?
And right,
man, it's led me through a thousand different small steps to ultimately my business partner and I getting on a podcast one day to have a conversation with our clients and somebody calling us and saying, hey, could you guys help us with that too? And we end up naming the podcast Wealth Without Wall Street because that's what we were trying to do, trying to pursue. And it's evolved to coaching people all over the country, having mastermind members that are international, and just a lot of fun stuff, man.
That's great. So tell me about growing up. So let's go way back. Tell me about growing up, your folks, how you were raised, and then really a quick version of kind of birth into college. Did you go to college?
I did.
Yeah. Birth. Just give me that overarching view.
Yeah. So, you know, grew up really blue collar. My dad was a contractor, right? Anything you could think of, roofing to remodeling.
Yeah.
That's what he did. And
business owner.
Yeah. Well, yeah, self-employed.
Self-employed. Right? There you go. I got you. I mean,
he had a business license.
Yeah.
I think he had a business license, but definitely worked for himself. And that's how I made a lot of money. My mom was a school teacher.
Okay.
And they split up when I was in the first grade. So I moved a lot growing up. And my mom was, you know, I remember as being in second grade, she goes to Auburn to finish her last year of college. And she was taking like 25 hours a quarter to finish because she had to.
And
right?
She had an 8-year-old.
And a 16-year-old. And so it was pretty crazy. And so we, our 15-year-old, I guess. But we were kind of leading ourselves while she was at school. And we were going to the grocery store at 10:30 at night. And I didn't know why until later in life. And I realized it was because she was on food stamps. And she was too embarrassed to, you know, to go during normal hours because she didn't want people to see her. And, you know, but I got to watch her work really hard. Yeah. And my dad was around, but just didn't live in the house. And I saw, you know, him, you know, I learned a lot of money habits, good and bad, from both of them, right?
Sure.
My mom spent money until she got to a point where she would get nervous and she would put her cards in a Tupperware dish and freeze them and put them in the freezer. And that's
old how school Dave Ramsey type stuff.
I mean, that's how she couldn't spend money on a credit card because it was frozen. You know, she'd have to wait for it to thaw out. My dad, you know, going to the pawn shops and, you know, pawning his guns or pawning his, you know, air compressor or something like that to pay mortgages. But all of that, you know, led to a point of me realizing, one, I didn't want to do manual labor. Two, I needed to figure out some way to use my brain, even though I wasn't really applying it a whole lot. I thought I was going to be a professional baseball player. And, you know, every little kid playing baseball thinks that. Sure. So it wasn't like I was really good or anything. And tried to play baseball in college. Didn't work out. My arm was no good. And ultimately ended up at Auburn. It's where I ended up meeting my brother-in-law. I lived with him for 2 years. His daughter follows him, his sister follows him the next year, and he graduates, and I end up taking care of her. And
nice.
The rest is history there.
Now, where did you go to high school? Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Montgomery.
Okay.
For the most part, in and around Montgomery, but I went to Lee High School in Montgomery.
Robert Lee.
Yeah, man.
Awesome. Now, how old are you?
I am 46, about to turn 46. 47.
Okay. Zach's a little younger than you are. He's in his 30s. So you went to Auburn, met your wife there, it sounds like.
Yep.
What'd you study?
Everything. Yeah. I first was going to be a horticulture major. I thought I was going to do landscape design.
Okay.
And then I decided I was going to become an accountant until intermediate accounting and realized that that was
for me.
That was not it. Got out with the D, best D I ever made. Yeah. And ultimately went and sat down with my counselor. He's like, hey, how do I get out of school here? Right. I just finished my, you know, my third sophomore year, it seemed like. And I was I was trying to figure out what's the path out. And she said, what do you like? I said, like finance. She goes, okay, great. You just need to take the second intermediate accounting. I said, what's next? She said, well, you could do business management. You get all the courses. You can take electives in finance. And so that was my degree, business management.
So when you graduated, what did you do from there? Because that first step in a lot of people's lives is kind of a holdover step.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I got to go make money. It's not what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. So leaving Auburn, what did you guys do?
Yeah, actually, man, I really wanted to get in the financial space.
Yeah.
And I showed up to one of these big box chains
and
they had this like 5-interview process. I went through all 5 interviews, and at the end of the 5th interview, they were like, no, you're not a fit. Like you got no friend. It was actually in Birmingham. I was interviewing in Birmingham. They're like, you got no friends, no family in Birmingham, and your family doesn't have a whole lot of money. So it's not like you're going to make any money. So the answer is no. And best no I ever got, to be honest.
That's incredible.
I feel like I would have failed miserably. I wouldn't be sitting here with you today because I wouldn't have made it. So I took a job with a company called Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And I started, you know, washing cars.
That is one of the biggest hustles there is.
Man, you're washing cars and shirts and ties. And, you know, what attracted me there is that few people knew this, is that they hired and employed more millionaires, you know, like people who made $1 million a year than any other company in the U.S. at the time. I don't know if it's still true, but
wow. They
had more people, they were paying $1 million or more in the company than any other company. And so, of course, I was ambitious, and I got promoted like 4 different times over a very short period of time. I was in 4 different states and was on the fast track up the corporate ladder, man. I was growing, and then my wife got into dental school at UAB, and that ended the moving cycle.
Yeah.
And so that.
Oh, so you were moving around with Enterprise.
Yeah. I was, you know, started in Alabama, went to Georgia, then up to Maryland. So I was moving around, and ultimately it ended in Huntsville, and she got into dental school at UAB, and I knew, okay, well, now my pool of opportunity just went like that.
Now, okay, so let me go back to this, because Jackie and I moved a lot when we were first married before kids. Did you guys enjoy the moving? Did you and your wife enjoy the moving, or did you just work so much when you were with Enterprise? Because typically the car rental business is a lot of hours.
Yeah, tons of hours.
So like, did y'all enjoy the moving?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, you know, I grew up moving a bunch, you know,
sure.
I went to like, I don't know, 8 different schools growing up. So
oh my gosh.
Like it was commonplace for me. So moving was not that, but it was, yeah, once we got married and weren't spending time with each other, because like you said, like, I mean, the time I'd get with her is if she'd come on a repo with me, like I'd go repo cars.
So washing cars, repoing cars, setting yourself up for future success. I love it.
Right.
So you guys ended up back here in Birmingham. What next?
So I decided at that point in time, it's like, okay, well, this is not going to be a fit. I need to figure out another option because I don't like ceilings, right? Mm-hmm. Didn't want to have limited options. So I actually went back to that same big box group and applied for a job. And I'm sitting there, I go back through the 5 meeting cycle.
Let me interrupt you. When we say big box, we're talking about the Merrill Lynch's, the Morgan Stanley's, the Schwab's, the places like that.
Yeah, so this was, so the one I had specifically interviewed at the first time was American Express.
Okay.
And it actually had switched names over that 4 years and became Ameriprise.
Yeah.
Right.
I've never heard of it.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, big national group, and I went and met with them, and they took me through that process because I was like, okay, I feel like now at this point in time, good part of my life, I can do that. I have a little more experience. I've been managing, you know, $1 million business, you know, and 15 people. And I was sick and tired of managing people. Sure. I wanted to be a manager of one, you know, that was really kind of another motivation for me. And I go back there and I interview through like over a 2 week period. I get that call from them and they're like, come in for the fifth interview. I do it. And they said, we're going to give you the job. And I was like, okay, great.
Great.
And I had this meeting. So that was at like 9 o'clock in the morning. I had like a meeting at a little local financial planning firm at like 10:30. And I was like, well, I got it on the books. I got nothing else to do. I'll just go over there. And so I go sit down with the guys and, you know, it was good environment. But I just left this one group and they had just told me, they said, hey, Russ, you're going to work 80 hours a week for the next 2 years, every Saturday. And that didn't scare me because I've been used to working almost that same amount of hours.
Yeah.
It wasn't what I wanted to do, but I've been doing it. And so I go work, I go over here to this other place and interview in, and, you know, they take me around talking to some people. And it was like, okay, we'd love for you to come back next week and talk to us again. I was like, well, I'd just be straight up. I just told this other group that I'm going to take the job with them. So if you have a process, if you can compile it into like today,
like if we could go eat lunch and then come back and finish in a minute.
Yeah. If we can do that, I mean, I'm happy. I got the rest of the day, got nothing to do. And they're like, ooh, wait a second. So they went and they, you know, ran me around and talked me to a couple other guys. And there was another guy pretty close in age to me. We're sitting there and I said, hey, how many, just ballpark for me, how many hours do you work a week? He's like, 35 or 40. And I was like, sold.
Done.
I found my place.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I got back into the financial space.
So you had not taken any of those financial tests. You go work at this place.
Yeah.
Here in Birmingham. You're working there. So is this the first part of your financial background?
Yeah, that's the start of it.
So what did, when you went into this office, what were like the first steps of that? Like where did that journey begin? Like what did you start off doing?
Well, you have to take a lot of tests.
A lot of tests.
Yeah. So I initially took these different securities tests, right? To be able to do all that stuff. I took some insurance tests. And it's ultimately just starting to learn a bunch of lingo. Like lingo that I was
vocabulary.
Not stuff that I was familiar with, right? Mm-hmm. Like my dad and I were not talking about his, you know, investment portfolio.
Sure.
Right? You know, my mom was not showing me all the real estate she had purchased in her life. Yeah. Like that was not a thing.
Yeah.
So it was all foreign to me outside of, you know, school books, right? But real life and school books, a lot of difference. So a lot of times for the first couple of months, man, it was just taking tests, passing tests, and then going out and trying to introduce people to ideas that I was learning. And that's super hard, man.
Yeah. So who trained you in all these financials? Who was your, like, the person that was there that was just, like, walking you through that? Because I know you guys aren't you're not a huge believer in the whole, in Wall Street and the stock market and all that. But that was you had to learn it first to figure. Because here's the thing. With learning, there's two things to learning. Number one, you learn and you build on that knowledge and it makes you better. Number two is you learn and you realize, hey, this ain't right. This is not what you believe.
Yeah.
So who was the person that trained you in all this?
Yeah. So, yeah, you learn from peers, mentors, and heroes, right?
That's right.
And for me, there was a guy that was a couple of years older than me that was there. His name's Justin. Mm-hmm. And, like, he and I connected, I think, from sports background and kind of same upbringing, it sounded like, right?
Yeah.
You know? And he was the guy that I spent a lot of time with. I mean, for those first 4 years, very instrumental. And then ultimately I was there for 11 years and he and I did a lot of like joint stuff from that point forward. But man, it was having somebody who had blazed that trail 3 or 4 years before I had and was willing to teach somebody who knew nothing,
right,
but eager to learn.
Justin's wonderful. Justin was on 5 or 6 episodes ago.
Nice.
Justin is a huge mentor of mine as well. I mean, I love Justin. He played football at UAB about 5 years. He was leaving as I was getting there. And so I don't know him during that time, but I've gotten to know him the last 4 or 5 years. He's wonderful. So the financial world, where did you first? So a lot of what Wealth Without Wall Street is known for is IBC. And we've talked about IBC on here a pretty good bit. IBC, for those who don't know, is the infinite banking concept. So there's you got the infinite banking world. You got the people over here that just think it's the best thing since peanut butter. And you've got your other people over here that thinks it's the devil. Okay. I mean, they do. Like, it's just the way it is. You got all these people over here that love it, and you got the Dave Ramsey people that hate it. And right. So we've talked about this. You've probably talked about it at length. I've talked about it at length with different people. So the IBC world,
yeah,
this is something it sounds like you were introduced to when you were working at Nylon. Tell me about like that. What? How did you get introduced to it? And what was the light bulb moment for you with infinite banking?
Yeah, man. So that is really the journey. So up to 2008, I was like looking to people to like explain the markets to me because I didn't understand it, right? Yeah. Like they teach you all this financial software and how to read the software. And you have a lot of like wholesalers, people who work for these, for mutual funds and stuff like that. And they'll come in and all these managed fund groups, right. They'll come in and teach. So a lot of the teaching is coming from the market, right? They're teaching you. And then you're putting it in this financial software to try to learn what standard deviation means and beta and all the different stuff.
Right.
Well, I thought I'd understood that. And 2008 happens and the market crashes. And there I am literally, palms up to the sky saying, hey, what happened? And I'm going to Justin. I'm going to all these other mentors I had and saying, what happened? And the answer is, I don't know. And that wasn't the scariest part to me, Thomas, is the answer is that when I asked the same question, is that what's going to keep it from happening again?
Sure.
Nobody had that answer.
Okay.
And I'm a guy that likes to be in control, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I did a lot of
dumb things. Most athletes do.
Yeah. Done a lot of dumb things in my life, but only to a point where I felt like I was still in control of what the thing was. At least in my brain, I thought I was in control. Mm-hmm. And this was super scary, man. And so I didn't know what to do. And there was a conference that we would go to every January, and it was all over the country. And January 2009, it was down in Orlando, Florida. And so I'm down there, and I hear this older gentleman talking, Nelson Nash, the author of that book, Becoming Your Own Banker. He's talking on the stage, as he would do. I'd seen him every year for four years prior.
So this is the fourth time you've heard him?
Yes.
Third or fourth, whatever.
Yeah, so 2005, 6, 7, 8. This was the fifth time.
Okay. Is he giving the same talk every time?
Same talk.
Okay, so let me go back for the people that don't know. Nelson Nash is what in most people would consider, I want to say invented, but like
the founder,
of Becoming Your Own Banker, which is a phenomenal book. If you want to dip your toe in the world of infinite banking and learn more, it's a great book, but he is the one that really brought it to the mainstream as opposed to it being a private thing that only the wealthy did. Correct.
Yeah. He just explained it, right? He broke it down.
Such a good job doing it too.
I mean, he didn't invent whole life insurance. He didn't invent borrowing money against a whole life insurance policy, but he just explained it for the UMEs of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's up on stage and he's doing like a 15 or 20 minute gig because it's like a 3-day event and they have lots of things they're covering. And there's 300-400 financial advisors, professionals in the room. And normally what would happen, Thomas, is he would get off the stage. I would turn to somebody next to me and say, now remind me what that's about again. And the response would be, oh, that's using whole life insurance too. And I'd be like, stop.
Done.
I don't need anymore. Because up to that point, really, I was so arrogant that I believed the only reason somebody would sell whole life insurance or use whole life insurance is that they weren't smart enough to have a securities license or know how to invest in the securities markets.
Wow.
I mean, that's the way I thought.
That's great.
Well, this time though, obviously I was like, all my paradigms have been busted.
Because this was a post-crash.
It was right after
the crash. So you've listened to this guy four times. On the fifth time, you started listening deeper because of the crash.
Timing's everything for most people, right? Most people have an experience, something's going on, and they're willing to listen.
Wow.
And so I said, so he gets off the stage, and at that time there was like breakout sessions. And I went and looked at the list, and one of the breakout sessions was on this whole concept of infinite banking. I was like, that's where I'm going. And so I went and sat in a breakout session. I heard this guy break down just the simplest way of using it. He's talking about like buying cars. I mean, and I was like, this makes so much sense. So at the end of the speech, he was like, hey, by the way, if you guys want to, you can go buy that book, Becoming Your Own Banker, out in the hallway. I walked out there, I buy the book. That was the last day. I fly home from Orlando. It was in Orlando, Florida. I fly home to Birmingham, Alabama, where I am. I read the books, a couple hour flight. I turn the book over, Thomas, on the back of the book, he put his home address and his home phone number. And there it reads, Rocky Ridge Road, Birmingham, Alabama. And I'm thinking,
10 minutes from my house.
I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. Like this guy, I've seen him in Arizona and, you know, Louisiana and Florida. And here he is in my backyard. And so I made it my mission from that point forward to go and learn more about it. I remember bringing the book and sitting it down, talking about Justin, sitting it down on Justin's desk and the other founder in the firm we were at, and saying, hey, tell me why this doesn't work. You know what the response was?
What?
It doesn't. I was like, but why? And they're like, I don't know. I was like, well, that ain't good enough. We got to figure it out. And so from that point forward, man, it was like everything I could do to learn. So I found out Nelson Nash had this once a year event where he bring all these practitioners from all over North America to talk about it. Well, I just missed that event, but I'm talking to him, right? I've called that number. I'm talking to him.
Yeah.
And he says, well, a couple of things. If you really want to learn, you can buy actually the recording to the event.
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, tell me where. And so he buys it. I remember sitting down that week, that next weekend. And this is when you had the, you know, still putting in the DVDs and stuff like
that. DVDs, CDs,
yeah. Yeah, whatever, into the thing. And I sat there for Saturday and Sunday, and I just watched like 16 hours of content. And my wife's like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is this thing. I think this is
working.
This is the game changer here. And the beauty of it is that at the end of every one of those sessions, each one of those presenters would put their email address and their phone number. And I just started calling them. I mean, I traveled lots of places across the country. We even had people that came to us, got on Zoom calls. I don't think it was Zoom, whatever that GoToMeeting was something.
No, it was, what was the thing called? It was, what was the thing called? I know it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
GoToMeeting, I think, is the last one I can remember for Zoom, but WebEx, you know, some of that stuff. And we would get on those calls and, you know, I got to learn a lot. And then actually there was a guy out in Kansas that was teaching a bunch. And so I flew out to Kansas and I spent a lot of time with him taking, you know, courses and stuff, trying to learn it. And man, it was a ride for sure.
So how long were you at Nowlin with Justin and that team before you left there and started on your own thing?
Yeah, so 11 years.
So you were there 11 years. How long were you guys doing IBC there before you exited?
Yeah, so we found out about IBC in 2009, and sometime in late 2009 is when we actually really started doing it. Took probably about 6 months of trying to prove it wrong.
Sure.
And even after being encouraged by it, still real skeptical.
Yeah, no, I get it.
So up until the end of 2015. So,
okay.
Yeah, almost 5.5, 6 years.
So 5 or 6 years of knowledge, being there, learning it, the ins and the outs of it. So you go and you start Wealth Without Wall Street. We're in an elevator. Hey, what's Wealth Without Wall Street? Go.
Yeah. What's Wall Street's a movement of people who want to become financially free, who don't want to invest in the stock market, who don't want to wait till they're 65, and don't want to wait to have to pay off all their debt until they can actually start enjoying their life. And that's what Wall Street was birthed out of, was the idea of how do we do that?
So I asked you, I was messaging yesterday, and I said, what is Wealth Without Wall Street? And you said, there are 4 companies underneath that. Explain that. I don't understand that. Explain that to me.
So Wealth Without Wall Street is really a brand.
Correct.
Right. It's a podcast. It's a YouTube channel. It's a community. So we have like 8,000 people in a private community that just talk about this. This is what we talk about. But underneath that brand, I mean, we help people implement the infinite banking concept. So we actually have a whole group of insurance coaches that will help people strategize and help them implement. And, you know, we take people through a coaching process. We believe it's an education first. And so people pay us to come in the door and to teach them. How does this apply to their situation? How do they strategize around it? And then ultimately, if they want to implement it, then we have contracts with different insurance companies. We can help set them up and have a whole team that follows through the process after that. Then we also run a coaching business.
Okay.
So our coaching company is meant to truly help people who want to be financially free. And infinite banking is really a tool and a process, right? So the tool is the whole life insurance policy. Infinite banking is the process of using the tool. But for me, you know, what was the difference maker for me is there I am sitting in 2016, and I personally have been putting large amounts of money, you know, 6 figures into whole life insurance policies, which was a large percentage of my income at the time. And I was sitting there going, but what do I do with it, right? Because I knew I didn't want to invest it in the markets, right? And I'd left a financial firm that still, embraced infinite banking, but still I walk in every door and there's a ticker on the wall, sure. Right? Yeah. And the market's still very prevalent. And I'm like, I don't want to invest in that. What do I do? And I be honest, like real estate, I knew people who owned single family homes.
Yeah.
I bought a single family home and it had not been great for me. Like it wasn't something that really fired me up. And I was like, what do we do? How do we build passive income, right? Like how do we start taking this money and turning it into money? And I had no idea. So that's where the podcast came in, is because I'd have a guy like you come in and start sharing like, oh man, I'm running this business over here. I'm investing in apartments over here. I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. I'm thinking about, you know, this other guy over here who'd be great for that. And I'd want to share that idea with him. It's like, well, that's not, you know, really simple. Why don't we do this thing called a podcast? And by the way, it was a younger guy in our office said, you guys ought to start a podcast. And Joey and I were like, how do you do that?
Yes.
Because I hadn't even listened to a podcast at that point.
And by the way, these guys have eclipsed over 500 episodes, which is a testament to the consistency and longevity of what you guys are doing. That's wonderful. Because I say, if you do more than 10 episodes in a podcast, you're in the top 10% of all podcasters. Isn't that crazy?
It is. I mean, it's a labor of love.
It is.
You know, I mean, as a podcaster, like you're doing this to have cool conversations.
Right.
But ultimately, you're learning, and hopefully you're learning alongside of the person who's watching and listening.
And in relationships too, I think that anytime you have someone on your podcast, you sit down with them for an hour and you create something. Sometimes it's deeper than others. Sometimes it goes on and sometimes it doesn't. But as you know, the relationships that we build in anything, in insurance, in financial markets, and just in podcasting, I mean, there's something that I can help you with down the road. Yeah. And there's something that you can help me with down the road. And then that's because if we're in this business, ultimately that's how we're going to grow together in all the different ways. So, okay, so you've got insurance coaches, you've got insurance business, you've got the coaching business. What else?
So we also reluctantly built a mastermind.
Okay.
I have a friend of ours, he runs a publicly traded company, and he tells Joey and I one day, he says, man, you guys are the passive income kings. Now, I'm like, no.
Bro. Yeah.
I'm not the passive income kings. He's like, but this guy's had, you know, 9-figure exits. And he's like, in the world I live in, people are always talking about investments and opportunities to grow money. But nobody is building passive income. They're just buying businesses. They're buying investments. They're doing big deals. He's like, but that's all you guys talk about. That's all I've heard you talk about. And we're like, well, because that's what we learn, right? Like we learned that's the path for us. And he's like, man, we need to build a passive income mastermind. And I was like, man, I don't want another company, man. I've got almost as many companies as, you know, the Duggars had kids. And I'm like, bro, I don't need any more companies. And he's like, well, let's just do it. We'll do a retreat. We'll go up to Nashville. It'll be easy for people all over the country to come into.
Yeah.
And we sent out 35 invites. We had 32 people come. And, man, we just had 2 days of really cool conversations talking about how do we build streams of income? How do we reduce our taxes through creative tax strategy? And what are people doing that just is unique that maybe just our everyday circle isn't talking about? And that was like the birth of the Passive Income Mastermind. It was about 3 years ago. And ultimately that's grown, and we've grown another mastermind, you know, for people who aren't quite at that, you know, 7, 8, 9-figure level. And it's been a lot of fun.
So insurance, coaching, mastermind, you said there was four. What's the fourth one?
So the fourth one is the brand, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So the brand is we run the community out of it. We run we have all these courses and content that we've built. And so it's become a great model for us to kind of continue to teach. It's kind of a financial education model.
So with whole life insurance, one of the biggest knocks on it, it's expensive. It's cost money. So you just said you're loading a lot of money in these insurance policies. And you and I could sit talk for an hour on just the logistics of insurance and what it takes and all those different things. And the policies can be written in different ways, whatever. Talking about income, because you've got to have a decent income in order to start this insurance passive income. Because I tell people all the time, come up to me all the time. I mean, once a week, hey, I want to help do some passive income. Well, you got to have income in order to make that income grow. Like, because if it's not, that's called active income.
Right.
So where did you first make, I hate to say make all your money, but like when your income started growing, what did you do to make your income grow at the beginning in order to start whole life insurance, IBC, that thought process?
You know, so in the financial advisory space, initially it was just growing assets under management, right? And did that for, you know, 5 years as I was building that up. And then I take this book of becoming your own banker. I take it to my three biggest clients at the time. And I say, hey, would you read this book and give me your feedback? Like, I want to know, like, I'm seeing it one way, but I really trusted. They were good business people. They were smart. You know, a couple of them were doctors. Like, tell me what your feedback is. And the resounding feedback was like, dude, we all need to be doing this. This is what we've been looking for. I didn't know it. So, I mean, I became pretty well known in that space. Like, I spoke on a lot of stages, you know,
talking about IBC.
Yeah, talking about IBC. So my income grew. Then my wife is a dentist, right?
And
so,
you know,
we started a dental practice for her. And, you know, that's another, you know, business that we built and ultimately grew that. So it was just kind of one of those things where both of us were making lots of active income. And so I had a good amount of residual income that I could, you know, left over, I could take and start putting into these whole life insurance policies.
So you've got money loaded in these life insurance policies, and then you take that money from there, borrow that money from there, and then invest that into whatever passive income stream. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah. First, I mean, the concept was, it was so hard for me to figure out. So let me tell you the first deal, which this is what unlocked it all for me.
Okay.
My wife starts her dental practice at the end of 2008. Great timing for the market,
perfect.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, so she starts her dental practice December 28, 2008. I had been managing her dad's money. He had inherited a good amount of stock from his father, who had just recently passed. He was a president of a bank out in Kansas. Well, that bank had gotten bought by Bank of America. And so he's sitting there on a ton of Bank of America stock. And he was getting a dividend, right? Most people would say, oh, I'm passive income. I got own stocks to pay dividends. Well, he's getting a dividend. And that wasn't big money, right? So on a, you know, seven-figure portfolio, it's like $600-$700 a month. But that was good, right?
Yeah.
So he's getting that coming in. And I set up a stop loss. For those people who don't know what a stop loss is, just means that if the market or the stock price falls a certain price, it will sell it. Right, because there's certain metrics that say if it falls, you know, 15%, it'll drop to 25%. If it drops 25%, it'll go to 50, right? And this is a bank stock. And back in those days, those were pretty flat. Well, what happened is in late 2007, as the financial market started going down and the banks were the financial sector were the leading edge of it, it triggered those losses. And so what happened is he's sitting on cash for about a year and a half.
Because you put a stop in there.
Yeah, put the stop loss in there. And so
if it goes up to a certain amount, it will sell. No, you didn't put a ceiling on it. You just put a basement on it.
I put a basement on it. So let's just say it was trading at $50 a share. And I said, okay, if it drops to $38 a share, we're going to sell 40%. If it drops to $30 a share, we're going to sell the 100. And that's ultimately what it did. It ended up dropping to like $3 a share. But before it went to $3 a share, my father-in-law did not like me because he was like, you sold the one thing that my father, you know, just loved. And he said, never sell this stuff. And he would never sell it. And you sold it. But then obviously a couple months goes by and he's like, thank you so much for putting that in place. Because otherwise we would have had thousands of dollars instead of, you know, hundreds or millions of dollars. And so here's the story. The reason I tell that is that my wife is sitting there. She goes to get a bank loan to build out her dental practice for about $750,000.
Mm.
The leading lender in the dental world is Bank of America. And so I'm sitting there reading this book, Becoming Your Own Banker, about how people who have deposits at the bank, the bank turns around and takes those deposits and lends it back out sometimes to them or their family members. And I'm like, oh yeah, I see it. Like his money sitting in cash right now, they're ultimately paying him pennies for his money and lending it out to his daughter at 8% interest.
And going to lend it to $5 more. They'll lend it eight more times.
And that was the first deal I did toward the end of 2009. I went to him. I said, okay, this is what we need to do. I got an answer for your money. Like, this is the first advisory thing I'd given since 2008. I was like, we need to pay off her dental loans and have her redirect the payment and start paying you. And we had that conversation. We papered the thing. And she was paying him like $8,000 a month for 10 years before she sold her dental practice. And so I'd gotten to see, that was my real experience initially as to what are people doing with it, right? Like, I knew a lot of people who are using it to buy cars and go on vacations and all the stuff that you can't make money in, right? but I really didn't know what real people were doing with this. And that was my first experience. And so for me, I kept trying to figure out, what do I do now? How do I make more of those things? Like, okay, well, I don't have any business loans, what I do, so I can't do that. Sure. Like, it's just, it was a search.
So took his money, gave it to your wife. This is the first time that y'all were your own bank.
Yeah.
You used the dad's bank, and then she paid the dad back.
Yeah.
Did she pay him back with interest?
Yeah, she paid the same exact interest she was paying the bank. So she was paying 7.95% interest.
She paid him.
And he was like, well, what should she pay? I was like, she should pay you 7.9. And he was like, okay. And I was like, here's what we're going to do. You don't need the cash. Let's take that cash flow and let's insure her life. Mm. Because now you're going to have a place for this cash to go.
That's it, yeah.
And in the event that something were to happen to her, that secures your loan. He's like, oh, cool. So we set up an insurance policy of my wife using that, you know, roughly $8,000 a month or whatever it was, and started paying that back. And then ultimately that became where I got used to family banking. There's a term out there called family banking. Well, I got to experience it firsthand there. And then he and I started looking to do deals together. We started looking for other opportunities that we could invest in things. We bought, you know, 30 acres out in Chelsea, where we live, and to build houses. Well, he was the finance, you know, for that. And so we started paying that off. My brother-in-law, who started a medical practice, I was like, borrowing, hey, you guys need to go to there. My other brother-in-law starts a vet practice. Like, you need to borrow from him. Like, these were just the normal conversations we started having.
Was that that wasn't the first policy you did from a family's perspective, was it?
Well, it was right at the same time. I don't remember who was first, but yeah.
So you guys did, this was one of the first policies you guys did. So you took the $8,000 that she was paying back her dad.
Yeah.
And she took that payment and said, hey, let's take this $8,000 a month and roll this in. And the $8,000 a month is a pretty good, it's a pretty good,
Pretty good
policy. Okay, so let's transition to this. Why are you so against Wall Street?
Mm. Man, here's the thing. Wall Street, I love the fact that you asked me in the beginning what my background was. Because you have to come from a perspective of what have you seen, right? And for me, I got to see that you would come to me and invest your money with me. Mm-hmm. And assume that I was going to do everything right with it, right? Because I have all the knowledge. You're a certified financial planner. Oh, you work this, you know, this really pretty building with, you know, screens that talk about the markets. Yeah. Like, you must know everything. And I'll tell you that the financial advisor space is full of ignorance. And I was one of them, man. It's so much where you hand me your money, I turn around and hand it to this person, they turn around and hand it to that person, they start handing off. Dude, there's more handoffs in the financial market than in an Army-Navy football game. I mean, you're so far removed from the end deal, right? I know you invest in real estate, right? But you know what's going on with it because either you're operating it or you know the operator of it. You can go touch it. You can see it. Well, in the Wall Street world, the average consumer has been taught not to see it, not to be a part of it, not to learn about it, to abdicate off the responsibility. And you're hoping in me, but to be honest, I'm hoping in this person, they're hoping in that person, they're hoping in that person, that person, that person. And by every time everybody gets paid around the wheel and it gets back to you, the idea of 12% returns don't exist.
Sure.
That's just a pretty picture that some people put out there. It doesn't exist. So for me, I realized like that was not one of the models I want to be. But then when I it took me a while to get, you know, aware of this concept that financial freedom is when your passive income is greater than your monthly expenses. So for me, when I go to most people who are invested in Wall Street, I say, well, are the things you're investing in producing a passive income for you? Mm-hmm. They're like, well, I mean, you know, I got this portfolio. It went up 12% last year. I'm like, that's not the question to ask you. Did it send you money this month that you could spend?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Well, okay. So did putting money in there reduce your monthly expenses? No. I was like, okay, so the simple question is, if financial freedom is defined by passive income being greater than monthly expenses, and every financial decision we make needs to be graded against that, are you getting closer to or further away if it's not giving you those things? And they're like, it's getting me further away.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's why we have such a passion to teach this, is because the average person has just been taught to abdicate this to somebody else, thinking they're smarter, they've got a degree, they've been doing it for 20 years, whatever the thing is, but they're not any closer to financial freedom from doing it.
What do you say to the people that love the market and the market has been successful for them, and the whole concept of indexes, S&P 500, things like that. You know, average of 8 to 10% a year. You know, the list goes on and on and on. Some years you lose money, some years you gain money. 2022, I think the market was down a pretty good bit. 2023 was up a pretty good bit. 2024 were up a little bit this year. So, like, because I'm in the market, okay? What do you say to the people that are just conservative, long, over time people in the market, and they have success? How do you not contradict that, but how do you argue that, I guess?
To be honest, I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I should have said this. If I didn't, I'll repeat it. But when you ask me, what is Wealth While Wall Street? Our mission is to help people who want to become financially free.
Yeah.
And man, if someone's having success doing something and it's meeting exactly what they want,
right?
Like, I'm not here to argue. Like, I'm not saying people cannot be successful. I'm saying in my experience, I was not successful. The people that I was around, I didn't watch them having success. I didn't see people, we're in a rising tide market, right? Like, sure. So since 2009, we've been in almost a straight bull run market.
No question, yeah.
And so for us, it's like, oh, everything I put in there, well, is that real success? Maybe. Yeah. But here's the thing, is that most of the people who come and reach out to us, they say, I'm unhappy in the environment I'm in. I'm unhappy at my job. I'm unhappy in my financial circumstances. I'm unhappy that my kids are growing older and I'm not able to spend time with them because I'm always having to be active at work. And I'm looking for an alternative. So when people come to us with that information, I say, okay, well then, are the financial decisions that you're making equaling what you want? If not, you need to make a change. If they are, keep doing it. Yeah. But why are you coming to us? So when we have people come to us, normally it's like, hey, I've been investing in the market. Yeah, it's up, whatever. Let's say 10%, 20%. It doesn't matter what the number is, but that doesn't equal paying the rent, the mortgage payment, the kids' tuition. It doesn't equal any of that. It's an account that at some point in time, I have to make a change. Here's the second reason I don't like the market, because I experienced this so many times in my life, is that you have to be right twice.
How so?
You have to be right when you buy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then you also have to be right when you sell.
Okay.
So when the market crashed in 2008, I knew advisors in my office that took all their clients to cash.
Oh, God.
And I was like, okay. So one, whatever the market went down to, they took them to cash. And they're anticipating it continuing to go to cash, right? So like my father-in-law, who's, everybody's nervous. They're panicked. They don't know what to do. So they said, we'll just stay here. Well, so then at some point in time, they have to know when are they going to get back in.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a guessing. That's a guessing game.
And what happens every time? Like, just you buy a house and you sell it. You always second guess. Well, did I sell it at the right time? You buy a stock and you sell it. You buy cryptocurrency and you sell. Whatever it is, you're always guessing. And you have this remorse. You're like, what if? What if?
Right.
Well, that's to me not freedom, right? Like, I want to be mentally free to do the things I want to do. So I want to guess as to whether or not, yeah, I've been winning up to this point, but when I sell it, when I need it, that's ultimately going to be the decision maker whether it's good. And then when I sell it, do I start regretting that I sold it because I'm like, and I see in what people, do in life is that this idea that I'm going to save money my whole life. I'm going to hoard money my whole life. And then I'm going to get to this point in the future where I've got enough money. And that enough money is going to last me the rest of my life, which is number one concern for all people in retirement is what?
Everybody.
Is what?
They run out of money.
I'm going to run out of money. So what do they do in retirement? Do you think they just splurge?
No, they hold on to it.
They hoard. And what a shame. And by the way, your kid, Tegan, right?
Yeah.
Is he going to want to do the same things with you when he's 42 as he is when he's 12?
He's going to want to do a lot more.
Yeah, but the same things. Yeah. Like, is he going to want to do Legos with you right now?
Yeah, no.
Or is he going to want to, throw the football?
He's not
going to
throw the football. He's going to want to go take ski trips.
Right. All the things. But the things in life we know, we experience this as parents of what we want to do with our kids today. Well, it's like, well, I'm not storing it up in a warehouse for the future, right?
Sure.
In my barns. I literally want to be able to use it and enjoy it. And be able to teach that abundant mindset.
Right.
So I see the market as a scarcity mindset for most people, not everybody.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so those are just a handful of reasons I would say why we're Wealth Without Wall Street. And like I told you, one of my good friends, one of my close friends is a president of a publicly traded company. When he started with that company, I was like, so you know,
almost offended.
No. I was at conflict ethically, man, because I was like, dude, this guy's gonna crush it. By the way, his stock's up 250%.
Yeah,
knew it would be. I just knew he would be, and I expect to go 1,000%. But I'm like, man, I just realized that I'm going to be in that game. And at some point in time, he's going to be like, hey, you know, I don't want to do this anymore.
Sure.
Everybody does. And then what do? Do I sell it then? And then I spent time, you know, in prison because, you know, because I knew he was leaving. You know, all these things. Like, I don't want to be writing right under, you know, Martha Stewart was here, exactly. Russ was here kind of thing. So anyway.
Tell me about this. And this is, I want all this on film as much as we possibly can. What do you think about the financial advisors that say, never sell? They say never sell your anytime you buy. Okay. And I'll give you a great example. I've dollar cost average since I was 18 years old. Since I was 18. It helped me buy our first apartment complex when I was 37.
That's awesome.
Okay. But I've still dollar cost averaged. But what we do is I have a theory and thought in my mind. And look, just give me your thoughts here of I'm somewhat treating the market like I treat my IBC. So I have an IBC, okay? So I have let's just use good round numbers, okay? So I have an IBC that's got, let's just say $100,000 of cash value in it. I use that money to go do different deals. So like, for example, JD Hill, you know JD, runs LandX, wonderful friend of mine. We've done some land deals with him where we buy 100,000, 50,000, whatever, and there's a return on that. It's passive income. It's not monthly, but it's passive income. Okay. I use the same thing with my managed account. So let's just use a good round number, $500,000 in a managed account. I do the same thing with that. Now, the rate's higher. I get that. What do you think about that? Because I've built this thing since I was 18. I'm 43. I've got a lot of just value there. And it has. It's gone down and it's gone up. But I've just been extremely consistent. Just got into the IBC world about 2 years ago, so I'm really, really new there.
Right.
What do you think about those two things running parallel with each other, where I'll borrow from my IBC to do things, but I'll also borrow off my LA, what we call LAL, Liquidity Access Line. You've heard of that.
Yeah.
Give me your thoughts there.
Well, one, is it working, right?
Yeah.
If it's working,
I don't,
you know, I'm not here to tell you to stop. I get that question a lot of saying, oh, I just learned about IBC. I have this investment account. Can I borrow against no margin? And if so, why wouldn't I just do that versus this? Or how are they different?
Yeah.
So just for those who don't know the differences, as you know the differences, talk about the differences. One, I think that's important. What have you experienced as a difference between the two?
The differences in the two are, we'll call IBC and we'll call LAL. IBC is my infinite banking concept account.
Yeah.
And my LAL is my managed account, which is any of the accounts that I have that are publicly traded accounts, whether it be index funds or some individual stocks, whatever. Okay. So if I have a savings account with that company, I can borrow 90% of that number. So say I have $100,000 in that savings account, I can borrow up to $90,000.
Right.
Okay. In my managed account, I can borrow up to 75% of that number. Again, good round numbers. Say you have $100,000 in your managed account, I can borrow $75,000 off of that account. Similarities are I don't have to pay interest every month, meaning like make a payment, which I love that in IBC and managed account. Like I go get a HELOC off my house, I got to make a monthly. I don't like that.
Right.
So that's why I use these two things. The rates are larger. So like my borrowing power right now is at like 8% for my LAL, 4% with my IBC. As you know, when you guys draw the contracts up for the IBCs, you can draw that whatever. Mine's 4%. We'll stay 4% the rest of my life, which is wonderful. So there's the different drawbacks. If you get close to your limit on a LA, this is the dangers. If you get close to your limit on a LAL, say I got $20,000 of wiggle room. Say the market tanks 15%.
Right.
They could freeze that.
Right.
Which is a danger. I do my best not to get anywhere close to that limit, but you never do know.
Right.
Those are the two. I mean, they're really, really similar, Russ, for like what I use them for. And I've got a ton of money out for passive income. Learned a lot from you guys. Learned a lot from like from being friends with Rock and just understand the differences in Rock and I love real estate and Rock hates real estate. You know, Rock's in a bunch of different other passive things, but the passive plays that we're in are more real estate based. So those are the differences. So I think the thing I will continue to do, I will continue to dollar cost average in the market, but I will not escalate that number.
Yeah.
I'm escalating my IBC. So like I'm starting 3 new policies on my 3 kids and I'm teaching them about how to use those things. I got a 15, a 12 and an 8-year-old, starting 3 of them really, really soon. And I'm paying them through my company. So this is all like all the different people we, you know, I think you can pay your kids like $12,000 or $13,000 a year, whatever.
Yeah, 13, 8, I think.
Yeah. All my kids will be on payroll because my kids do work. They do stuff. But all my kids will be on payroll and I will start policies through that. So number one, I'm getting a tax deduction off the top end. So let's just say it's just $12,000 a piece. You're looking at $36,000 off my top line that I don't have to pay taxes on. They're an employee. Granted, I got to pay payroll taxes, but then I will use that money to then start those policies for my kids that when I think about it, when my 8-year-old has a policy when she's 25,
that's crazy
what it's going to be worth. Now the key here, and this is what Justin's taught me, and this is, I know what you teach your clients, is how to use it. Mm. Justin sat me down one day and taught me. He said, if this is a savings vehicle, don't do it. He said, this is to be used, not just to get your 4% and get your dividend. It is to put the money in there, take it out. And I teach people this all the time. Use it twice.
Yeah.
Or 3 times or whatever. And so that's where my, I've just laid it all out there.
I love that.
It out there and talk to me about your opinion on that. I'm asking.
Well, so that's typically the question I love to ask is compared to what, right? So you have to have a comparison for us to understand the differences. And because you have experience, it helps you understand the difference. And when we're, you know, I live in this control environment.
Yeah.
I like to have control. So I asked other people, I was like, man, do you like control? If so, is there any scenario where you see your cash value in your insurance policy going down?
No.
Right? So we don't have the downside on that.
No doubt.
Is there a scenario where you could see your managed account losing value?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
So that creates a little volatility that some people are comfortable with.
Yep.
Some people aren't, right?
Right.
So there's one of the comparisons I usually use because as we're talking about borrowing cash, I know you use, hey, I have a savings account in there. I could put it in there. But if you have a savings account in there, what is it earning you?
Yeah, 5%. Nothing.
Yeah. We don't use it for that, right? So that's one of the reasons. Normally, you're in the market, be in the market. So if you're going to have money in your savings in a managed account, you probably are a little nervous of what's going on and that identifies different issues. So I would say, you know, so now we've got money in the market and we can borrow at, you said 75 cents to every dollar you have in there. So that's fine. I don't encourage people to go to 100% in their insurance company anyway, but I always like the option, right? To me, every deal that we do is about options.
Yeah.
I want the more options I can possibly have that only allows me to think differently. So for me, I'm looking at options and when I'm opposed to the market, I don't trust the market. I don't believe the market, right? So I personally wouldn't do it, but if you're having experience in it, is having good success, great. Yes, you can borrow against both. You mentioned the rate variability. You'll have more rate variability in the market than we will in our insurance contracts, right?
Insurance contracts are set.
Well, they're not all set, right? So, and we could go down a long rabbit hole for no reason to do that, but they move at a slower pace regardless of what's happening.
Correct.
Where the market moves sometimes daily or monthly, right?
It used to be 3%.
Right. It moves
and it's
fast.
8% now.
Yeah.
But that's based off of interest rates and things like that. And you know that.
So for us, I tend to say, hey, compared to what? Do I want volatility in my life? If I don't, then that's an issue. Do I want to have control? Do I want to be able to know that I'm going to have options to access more money if I want to? Yes. I don't ever want that scenario of somebody calling me and saying, hey, your account's frozen, or you have to have a margin call. You need to chip in money into the situation, right? And the worst part scenario is not that, imagine you went and just did 3 real estate deals and these deals are home runs, right? And so you're like, you're pulling cash from everywhere you can get it and you take a margin account loan, right?
Yeah.
And you put it into a real estate deal and now the market drops 55%.
Oh,
like it did on me in 2008, if that's possible, right?
Yeah.
And now your money are in great real estate deals. How are you going to make the call? What's going to happen?
Sure.
So now you're going to start selling things. When are you selling? At the high or at the low?
Low.
Now you're having to make the margin call by selling, by liquidating your account at a low. So now you just have reverse dollar cost averaging. And I saw that. I experienced that. I saw people going through that process. So I'm not calling it bad. I'm not wishing.
Right.
When it's working for people, great. But ultimately, like, to me, financial freedom is building things that I can trust more and more. The closer I get to deals, the closer I can be able to operate the deal, the closer I can know the operator, the less risk I take. People think, oh, well, if I'm comfortable with risk, okay, I invest more in stocks than I do in bonds, right? That's what you people used to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I had an old guy in 2009, I was sitting with him, and he had written on a piece of paper from the advisor he had met with before me, and then he had wrote next to it, stocks risky, bonds safe. And he's showing me his investment portfolio that was full of bonds that was down 85%. And he's trying, he doesn't understand. He's like, you see my piece of paper, I take notes on everything. How is that possible? Because what's going on in the markets we don't control.
Yeah.
Right? And do you see a scenario where your apartment complex drops 85%?
Not 85%, no.
Right.
Yeah.
Therein lies the difference of the way I think and how I think. And it's, you know, am I Chicken Little? Maybe. But I love just having options. I love having freedom and love not having to worry that that's on the table, right? I do different investment deals. They also have the option to go to zero, some of the deals I do.
Absolutely.
I've had some go to zero,
yeah,
right? But for me, I use the cash in the insurance contracts as my savings account, as the place that I'm going to have money to be able to flow to and from.
Right.
And I'm not going to worry about that piece.
Because it's not dropping.
Now my focus is on these other areas.
Would you call yourself conservative when it comes to the investing world?
It's difficult, right?
Yeah.
I think what most people would look at is, I mean, we have 21 different passive income streams. And lots of those are a little bit crazy. So
sure.
I think some people would say, man, Russ, you're crazy. You're super risky. I don't think I am.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I'm conservative. I'm definitely not, you know, risk averse for sure.
Right.
But I'm one of those that I take calculated risks.
Yeah. Of the people in your mastermind, I'll go back to your mastermind because I got a couple friends in your mastermind. Of the people in your mastermind, what is that avatar? What do those guys look like? I know you're going to say, oh, it's all over the map. Are they mostly business owners? Are they mostly W-2 guys? Tell me what that looks like.
I think most of them are self-employed, right? I'm going to keep going back to that word, right? I think most business owners, people who would use the word business owner, have a business license, probably have employees.
Yeah.
But when I think business owner, I think leave for a year, come back, and the business is operating better than when you left.
Sure.
Most of the people in our mastermind are self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
They have been successful in a large amount of areas.
Right.
But they are unsatisfied, at least before they came, and how they were truly impacting their passive income. They've been great at creating active income.
Yeah.
And what they were seeking is how do I take this knowledge that I have here and start turning active income into passive income? And then secondly, it's people who are looking to be in a circle of people that they just normally don't spend time with, right?
Yeah.
Our friends' sphere sometimes a little narrow, and we don't get to have conversations with other people that are just at a notch maybe above us or two notches above us and where we're wanting to go. And I think most of us that are in that group, that's our avatar. It's like we're never satisfied.
Yeah, I agree with you.
We're always seeking, like, consummate learners, right? Like, how do I get better? How do I grow? What's the next thing? Because our mastermind is focused on building 200% of passive income over monthly expenses. And it's an aspirational goal. But the reason we sat at that is because we wanted to think past ourselves.
Mm.
Like, you have three kids. It was like, what can I do to impact our kids? Like,
sure.
I have four kids.
Man.
What can I impact 100 years from now? What would I need to do to create a situation, to create a legacy to where they would be toasting me 100 years from now? Not from a vanity metric, but
no.
Like, man, I've impacted lives and so many more. Like, what needs to happen and how do I do it? I think that's the typical avatar in the room, is that they're just super generous people.
Yeah.
They're super smart, and they think down the road, they're big picture. They want to see things grow.
Right. What do you think the biggest mistake, because you're around a lot of these guys, what is the biggest mistake these self-employed people make that you consistently see?
Not planning their business to be sold.
That's great.
They're just not preparing. if the aspirational goal is to truly become a business owner, big B business owner, as Robert Kiyosaki would say in the cash flow quadrant, where you could truly leave and it would just run without you. Well, in order to do that means you have to put yourself in a position where you're hiring people, firing yourself, and getting in, you know, in a way which your business can scale.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, sometimes we just think too small. Mm. And I've made that mistake. You know, I've owned so many different businesses. I've made that mistake for so long. It wasn't until 4 or 5 years ago, we were having a conversation offline. I was telling you about another friend of ours who came in, and he started helping us implement in our business. He came in, Thomas, he said, "All right, tell me how much money you made last year." I told him. He said, "Great. How much money do you need to make to live off of?" And I told him the number. He goes, "Well, you made more than that." I go, "I know." He said, "All right, so here's the challenge. This is what we need to do. Our goal is to take the margin and reinvest into the business to the business can run by itself on its own. And then everything after that that you make, you get to splurge. You get to do whatever you want to do." And so for the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, you've seen us be building these passive income streams, but Joey and I have been building businesses and truly investing in people, like to where we have these businesses run by, you know, directors, by presidents, by people in the organization that is not us.
And those are businesses are the insurance, the coaching, and the mastermind.
Yeah.
And the brand.
Yeah.
So the goal for y'all, that's your active income.
That's active for us right now.
That's your active income. So you said you have 21 passive income streams. Give me 4 of your best ones right now. And when I say that, I've put money into this and it pays me this, and explain what the concept is.
Yeah. So the number one passive income stream that we have every single month is investing in land. You talked about a land deal a second ago. We interviewed a guy on our podcast probably 5 years ago, and he was walking on a treadmill and he's talking about buying raw land and small parcels, and from people who really didn't want it anymore, right? Usually out-of-state owners, maybe even owed some taxes on it. And he would buy it and then turn around and put it on Facebook, Craigslist, land websites, and sell it for 4x what he paid for it. But the key was he would sell it on owner finance terms, creating passive cash flow. And it was an interesting idea, but I was busy that day, whatever, I didn't recognize him. A year goes by, and I'm sure like you probably look at your stats to see, you know, hey, we measure ourselves on all these metrics. Yeah. Well, what about our podcast stats? Over the last year, what's been the most downloaded podcast we have? And it was that one.
Was it Podolsky?
Yeah, Mark Podolsky, The Land Geek. And I was like, I guess we should have him come back on. And so he comes back on the podcast, and this is late 2019.
Okay, let me stop you. At that point, did you invest with him?
Well, so that's what I was about to say. So we interviewed him at that point. I was super fascinated, and he taught a course. And so Joey and I bought the course. It was like $10,000, $8,000. I remember what it cost.
Yeah.
And so we bought the course, and we started doing the training. Now, Joey and I knew that he and I were not going to run the business. We had an assistant at the time that was working for us who wanted to flip houses. We're like, well, if you want to flip houses, what about flipping land?
Yeah.
Same thing, right? Well, not the same thing at all. Unfortunately, she was not successful in it because it just wasn't her avatar, wasn't her personality, what we use, her investor DNA. Mm. So we go to Mark and his team and we say, man, we know this is a model we want to do. We've gone to now 2 of their live events at this point. We've seen hundreds of people. We've talked to them. They're having success. And we say, how can we invest in this? So we built a partnership with the land group who was already doing it at scale. And we're like, can we give you capital, right? And us being a business together and use our capital to buy more land, use your team to do the deal, and we'll pay you X percentage out of it.
Sure.
And so for us, that's been huge. So we're about, you know, we did a webinar on this the other day, and I think we're at like 1.5 million in enterprise value on it. We're up to like 22,000 a month net in passive income from it.
Just on the land.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's by far the biggest impact we've had. Like we ran a short-term rental business.
Yeah.
And we scaled it.
Did you like that?
I did at first. Yeah. Like, so we hired an operator. I mean, this is a thing, man. I'm going to put an operator in every business. I'm not going to treat it as a self-employed thing. Right, I'm going to figure out how do I make it a business? And we scaled it up to 25, 26 units in a really short window of time. It was fun to talk about, met my investor DNA. I got to post it on Facebook. Hey, if you're running a business, you have somebody coming to town, whatever, here's place. And man, at one point we were doing $25,000, $30,000 a month net after paying our operator and that business. And then about a year and a half ago, the market really changed. And I think the hotel business got really aggressive. And we had a ton of one bedroom units. And so we were really out of position in the market. And I knew we needed to switch. I knew that we needed to shift to more of a midterm rental where people's homes who had been flooded, hit by lightning, tornadoes, whatever it is, we needed to be that place because we had experienced, we had a couple of three bedroom units and we had some people that had moved in our place because of those reasons and were there for like 6 months and we're getting the check directly from the insurance company for like $5,000 and we're paying $1,400 a month and rent for the unit.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't have all of the cleaning fees that normally you have. So sure. I was like, that's the model.
Yeah.
And for us, because we had an operator, it was one of those things where we knew that we were going to have to go buy a bunch of houses and it was going to take a lot of time and it was going to impact his income.
Yeah.
And so we actually ended up selling the business to him. And so that's been super passive.
Yeah.
We've owner financed the business to him and he's just been paying us.
So tell me this, when you put these operators in place, are you giving these operators a profit share equity or are they just getting a salary?
Dude, I hate salary so much. Yeah. We usually work off a performance model, but we always have a floor for them, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it may be a salary or a draw. Right?
Sure.
A guarantee to that. And I love finding people who have the ability to make as much money as they want. I never want to discourage that. And yeah. So for me, I love working in an environment where people have the ability to always increase their income. So for him, you know, we gave him a bottom line.
Yeah.
We knew that he needed X amount of dollars, but it was always really in our eyes a draw against profit.
Yeah.
And so we already allocated, here's a percentage of the business that we're going to pay a manager, whether it's him or somebody else. And he performed over that number more times than not. And we gave him percentages of that when he did.
Yeah.
And that's how we ran it. And that's how we run almost all of our business.
So here's my, and this is, help me with this fear. Here's my fear is when you do that, if you put Johnny in charge of this business and he's the operator, what's keeping Johnny from going and doing the same thing on his own?
Yeah,
that's the fear I have with some of these putting, and I agree with you. I love the model. I've got the model in a couple of things that I do, but how do you keep them from believing and doing their own thing?
Well, we use a tool called Culture Index.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar?
Yep, I am.
Do you use any tool like that whenever you're hiring people?
I haven't, but I just learned about it about 3 or 4 months ago.
Game changer, mm-hmm. right? Like as business owners, the thing that we will struggle with the most is personnel, hiring and firing.
Absolutely.
And never fired anybody that was super happy about firing them, right? Like maybe they were not fit for the company, but I just hate that, right? I don't want to be that guy. But in my experience up to that point, what I realized is that most of the firings that happened was a bad hire. Mm-hmm. I should have not hired him. Shame on me, man. I made a bad mistake, but I didn't know how to hire correctly. I was using my gut, as we always like to do.
Sure.
And I was using resumes and or the interview, which we end up hiring people who are a lot like us, right? Because that's the people we enjoy talking to. Person who sounds and repeats the same things we're interested in. Well, Culture Index is a tool where people actually say, I'm like this, not like DISC or Colby or some of these where you say, are you most like this or least like this? No, you choose the things that you're like. It's hard not to choose the things you like, right? So you're choosing. Yeah. And it tells you a lot about the profile. And so Joey and I have learned what the ideal operator profile looks like,
mm-hmm.
and who's going to have success there. And also, what are going to be those challenges? What are going to be those things? What's the likelihood this person is going to want to run and go do their own deal? And it just makes it really easy for us to be able to set it up. But also, remember I said the biggest mistake of all business owners is what? Not preparing the business to be sold.
Yeah.
So for us, I'm not scared. You know why? Because I'm like, if you've been working to build a business up, to grow it, and you've learned everything there is, man, why would you ever want to go start from scratch? Just buy mine.
Just buy this one.
Right? I mean, Walker Dibble has the book, you know, Buy, Then Build.
Yeah.
Right? I was on a call with him recently. It was super cool to meet him in person. And like, that's the model, right? It's quit building businesses from scratch, buy existing ones, and then improve them. And I'm like, to me, every one of our operators, every one of my businesses for sale. I mean, we were approached last year by private equity.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing the deal, but man, it's like, you got to be ready. You have to be in a position. And you need to let people know, like, go to market. One of the best things I ever learned from one of my business mentors is that before he ever sold his business, he went to market every single year for 4 years. He learned every single time he went what people wanted more in his business. Mm-hmm. So then he could go back and work and improve that, come back and improve it and improve it. And also he started to find the real people who are interested in buying it.
Yeah.
So when he finally got to the point where they're selling a company for $3 billion, he knew exactly who's going to sell it to.
Wow. Land, short-term rental. What are two? Give me two more passive incomes that you are really doing good for you guys.
Yeah. So we've gotten involved in lots of different syndications, right? Because in this Passive Income Mastermind, our podcast, I've got to know a lot of operators, a lot of people doing deals. So it doesn't matter if it's ATM machines. That's one of the ones you see in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got to meet the operator, the sponsor of that deal, spent a lot of time with him. Mm-hmm. He comes to our events. He's in our mastermind. So that's been one that's been a consistent earner for us. Multifamily stuff, apartment complexes. Yeah. I mean, there's one of the guys that's in our mastermind. Like, I'm telling you, you can't have a normal conversation with this guy because he thinks and breathes multifamily. You'd be like, man, Robert, tell me about your family. He's like, you mean my multifamily? I mean, like, everything is lives and breathes it. And that's the kind of people that I want to be investing in. Like, I want to invest in people that are like, hey, what do you think about starting up a project over here? He's like, nope.
Nope.
My market is this. This is what I do. I love that. That's been huge.
So when we talk about these things, you talk about the ATMs. I do know about the ATMs because Rock has invested in those syndications. So let me give the model out for everybody. Let me use a good round number. You give $50,000 to this ATM company. You give it to them. When you give it to them, they in turn give you $1,000, $2,000, $1,500, whatever, back per month. So you've taken money out of your policy.
Taking a loan from the insurance company.
Taking a loan from the insurance company. And then you give them X number of dollars, 50 grand.
Yeah.
And then they give you, let's just call it, say it $2,000 a month. Say they give you the $2,000 a month. Do you take that money and then live off of it? Or do you take that money and flow it back into your policy? Because this may be a long answer.
Yeah. So I'll give you a short answer.
Yeah.
Go to wealthaboutwallstreet.com /POS.
Okay.
That stands for Passive Income Operating System. Mm-hmm. And we literally give you the diagnostic of exactly what we do. But I'll tell you for those who won't go, you know, click the link and get the download, because it's an ebook, shows you exactly what we do. This was like a process, right? Part of this is like we were doing things, but we're doing things inefficiently.
Yeah.
And what I realized is I had to separate active income from passive income.
Totally.
Because if I run everything out of the checking account where I spend money to pay for work stuff or spend money to pay for vacations, And now I get investment money coming in there, it's not going to get recycled. It's not going to, human behavior is going to take over and I'm going to start consuming it. So we separated those things. So we put all of our investments on the right side, what we call the passive income side.
Right.
So any dollars that I'm not spending personally, every single month get flowed over there.
Okay.
And then from there, I use that to fund my life insurance policies, right? Every time those premiums come due, I make the premium payment, right? Whenever I want to invest into an ATM machine or a multifamily deal or mobile home park or self-storage and all the above, I take that account and I fund it, right? And so then I have the cash flow that comes from those repay that account. And so I use that line of credit where it's just constantly
flowing.
It's keeping that money in motion. And then even at the end of the year, or not the end of the year, beginning, depending on what you're looking at, when April 15th comes, right? As we're recording this pretty soon, the accountant's going to say, hey, your estimated taxes for 2023 were X, because he doesn't know, because all these K-1s I'm going to have coming in for the next 6 months. Well, I'm going to take a loan against that cash and I'm going to go pay my tax bill. Only if I haven't invested in enough deals that's written off all the income that I already have.
Right.
And that's the beauty of this, is that when I started keeping my money over there on the right side of the page and I quit paying taxes during the year, I started investing in deals toward the end of the year with that cash that actually not only gave me passive income, but also offset the taxes I was going to have to pay. And so it became a win-win-win.
It's a huge cycle. If you lost everything, because you guys have made a lot of money between the dental practice and your wife and your businesses, if you lost all your money and all you had was your knowledge and relationships, what would you go do?
I'd be a land investor.
Would you?
Man, I'm telling you, like, I've said this so many times, and Mark Podolsky is a close friend of mine.
Yeah.
I love that guy, but I'm not saying it because of any of this. I have seen so much success, and people that are super knowledgeable, super experienced in life to people who are teachers and driving, you know, forklifts and skid steers. Man, to me, if I would have learned about that deal as late as 7 years ago, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today.
Really?
That's all I would be doing. Because I've seen people who are doing 7-8 figures in that business, and they work 2 hours a week, 3 hours a week. It's truly a laptop lifestyle.
Yeah,
it's an opportunity where even if I had a reputation, what if I lost my reputation? Like, what if I did something really atrocious? I could still do that business because people don't know who you are. You're literally just mailing them, and I don't have to have money because I can mail you the thing. You say, yes, I want to sell your piece of land, and I can go to the market right now, and I can sell the land to someone else, and they give me the money before. I mean, it is truly the path to, in my opinion, to building a stream of income, owning a business that has residual income that can be run, can be scaled. Because I see people who do it, who like to do it, you know, as their own person, but I see people running teams of 20 or 30 people doing it, and they're doing it
huge
numbers. It's crazy.
If someone wants to find you, where can they find you?
Go to wealthwhitewallstreet.com. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously we're on YouTube, we're on any podcast app you're on, but I encourage you, like, if this is the kind of information you're into, go to wealthwhitewallstreet.com/free call. And one of our coaches answers those calls. They talk about the things that you're looking for. And, you know, we have a free community that points you to there maybe. But it's just a cool thing to be in a position where we get to do what we love.
We have this podcast. You have your podcast. Why does a financial company need a podcast? Well, tell me about that. I mean, like, are you getting customers? I mean, tell me why you guys have a podcast. It's extremely successful. If you've done 500 episodes, that's awesome. So tell me, why do you guys need a podcast?
Man, we started the podcast because we wanted to have a weekly conversation with our insurance clients. We had 500,000 insurance clients at the time. And I was having conversations, cool conversations with guys like you.
Yeah.
And they're telling me about deals they're doing. And I want to tell this person about it. And so Joey and I said, hey, let's do this podcast. And we started doing the podcast to have a weekly conversation with them. And burst out of that, our company just blew up. We doubled overnight. We literally have went fully remote, right? We don't meet with anybody one-on-one. And it's created where we had to create a big B business.
Yeah. You know,
Joey and I haven't met with an individual client in 4 years or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's created the opportunity for us. So I would say the largest way that most people find us is, you know, we've had 500 episodes, and Joey and I have probably been on another 500 podcasts.
Sure.
Other
just
than
like
ours.
This.
And it's just a great way to meet new people, to learn new things, and ultimately just to be able to serve in the way that God's called us to.
3 or 4 more minutes. What questions do you have for me?
Man, I just want to know, for you, like, how does this serve you? How does the podcast help you and the people that you're talking to?
We're not near as far down the road as you guys. You guys, I would be lying if I didn't say that y'all are not a model for what we do, as far as they're not selling anything. I mean, you are, but you're not. You're more knowledge and relationship based. And I think that's it. I don't know what life's going to be like for me in the next 10 years. I mean, will I still be doing food? I don't know. I love what I do. I love serving these people at Highlands College. I love it. But I like food, but I love business. So I love the deal making and things like that. And I love people. Mark Pettis, who's one of the president here at Highlands College, is we were hiking the Grand Canyon, and we're dragging. It's hard. And we come upon a group of people, and I start talking to them. And when I start talking to them, I get energy because I love people and I love talking to people. And he stops and he goes, I've never seen anyone like him that just gets energy from talking to people. So I enjoy it, but I also enjoy the relationships because I know there's something in 3, 4, 6 months where you could call me and say, hey, you know, so-and-so, can you help me with this? Yes. And I love doing that. I love connecting you with Johnny, who does this very, very well, from the guy that cuts my grass to the guy that, you know, sells shoes. I don't know. There's so many different things. So I want to create relationships so that I can use those relationships, not use in a bad way, but leverage those relationships for business down the road and relationships down the road. So that's the biggest reason I use this.
All right. So if I'm new to the podcast, what's the one episode that you're like, go listen to that one? That was a game changer.
We do a lot of different things. So Kendall Graveman's episode was fun. And so if you're looking for entertainment, Kendall Graveman, he plays professional baseball. It's awesome. We've had everybody from the guy that owns a wrestling gym to a wedding planner. The number one downloaded episode has been Jake Elkins' episode of him being a wrestling coach and how he's leveraged that to love on kids and change the world of wrestling. Number one episode. We've had so many different people out there. We've done a couple episodes that have been investing where it's just me and a guy named Luke just talking about different investing things. That's been a lot of knowledge there. Lindsay Miller is probably one of my favorite episodes because she's so fascinating. She's a 40-year-old and she's been a CFO of a multi-million dollar company, and yet she owns 4 or 5 businesses now. So I would say scroll through and see who you resonate the most with. And then from there, download that one.
So you asked me the question. I'll reverse it as far as what's the mistake that you see most business owners making? What's that for you?
The number one mistake that I see people making, and I did it for years, is trying to do everything. I got my life back because I coached college football for about 10 years. And I was used to working 90 hours a week and 80 hours a week. And I got a break when we got fired in North Carolina, and I went to work in Tennessee. And I went from 90, 95 hours a week, sometimes 100, to 75 hours a week. I got a break. So, but when I transitioned into being self-employed, as you say, I did it all. From washing dishes to cooking all the food to buying everything, and I did it all. And I was making good money, and I saved a lot of money. And I think that I had to go through that to learn. The amount of time that I have now is a lot more than what I have had in the past, and our business is continuing to grow. So the number one mistake people make, I think, is not hiring people to do the things, number one, that you don't want to do. Number two, the things you're not very good at. And then the third thing, which I'm working towards, that is to replace yourself. So you've talked about that before. The first thing is hire somebody to do the things that you don't want to do. Yeah. Life's too short to dread something every single day. Number two is there's so many things in here that I'm not good at, that Sierra is really good at, that Jonathan's great at, that Kristen's great at. I make less money, but as you grow, that becomes a non-issue. So you hire people like you've talked about that can, our business model with Meal Fit, with Table and Time, with Weddings Costa Rica, the things that we own, is our job is to make people's lives easier.
Yeah.
I need to do the same thing. I need to hire people that will make my lives easier. And the culture index thing that you talked about, I think is great because it shows us where people fit into what you're doing. And I got some people that don't fit real good, and I got some people that fit great. And so trying to get them to fit in those spots to make their lives and their quality of life better. Like I hired somebody, Sierra, my assistant, she's works her absolute butt off all the time. We hired Tanya to help alleviate some of the things that she's done, and it's helped. Yeah. So that's probably the biggest mistake I see people make.
Yeah, the concept of working in your area of genius avoids you working in an area of resentment.
Absolutely.
Very cool. So. Well, man, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Man, I am so thankful. Go to wealthwithoutwallstreet.com if you have any questions about any of the passive income, the life insurance, the IBC, any of that stuff. Russ is an absolute expert on that. So please go there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.